This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. According to a study done at NYU, 13% of workers in the 10 largest labor markets in the U.S. are what's called super commuters. Now, super commuters is a word I'd never heard, and I'm guessing that you probably haven't heard of it either, but here's the definition. They're people, men or women, whose job takes them away from home for days, weeks, or maybe even months at a time. And it's a lot more common than you might think. In fact, there was an article in Forbes recently that talked about how as many as 10% of the current U.S. workforce, the whole workforce, could be super commuting. In a lot of cases, super commuters are kind of forced into it by economics. Maybe it was the crash of the housing market and they couldn't sell their house to move to another place, so they have to commute. Or maybe it's the unemployment rate and they had to take some sort of a job someplace, even if it was very far away. But sometimes the decision to become a super commuter has to do with simply advancing one's careers and professional goals, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the biggest question, of course, is what happens to families when one person is a super commuter? Of course, there's no one answer. A lot of families have to deal with feelings of loss and resentment because of the forced separations, but other families find renewed love and romance and strengthening commitments to their families. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about this challenging but rewarding lifestyle that's affecting more and more of us every day. So if you're a super commuter, you have one in the family, you're about to be one, or you know somebody who is, you're not going to want to miss this show. I'm Armin Brott. We'll jump right in right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
There once was a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Well, I'm taking Algebra 2 in a foreign language.
Oh, so you can talk to unicorns?
Exactly. Unless they're French.
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find the classes he really needed. Getting into college doesn't happen magically. Learn more at knowhowtogo.org.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Megan Bierce, who's the author of Super Commuter Couples, Staying Together When a Job Keeps You Apart. Megan, welcome to Positive Parenting.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start you off with a definition, I guess, of what super commuters are.
The general definition of what a super commuter is someone who travels about 90 miles or more for their job. And so that could be somebody who drives perhaps between Dallas and Houston two or three or four times a week. It could be somebody who gets on a plane and flies from San Francisco to L.A. for the week. It could be consultants and things like that.
So there's some overnights involved there, is that right?
Well, there can be. It doesn't have to be. The main definition is more about the mileage. So in some parts of the country, people do it every day. But then there's others who will leave on a Monday and come back on a Thursday.
I don't know, just hearing 90 miles and thinking of driving that every day just makes my back hurt. Just even hearing the idea of it. So how common is that? I mean, it's some of the research you talked about says that it's somewhere between 3 and 13%, it sounds like.
It is. It's becoming very common. The biggest study that's out there right now is out of NYU from the Rudin Center, and they based it on 2009 census data. And, yeah, some places it's as high as 13% of the workforce, and those are areas like Dallas and Houston. San Francisco and Los Angeles, that corridor is really common, is an area in Phoenix. But it's nationwide, it's international as well, and continues to grow.
And what's behind it?
There's really three factors behind the rise of it. One of them has to do with the economy. So if you think back to around 2008, 2009, people are getting laid off, their houses are underwater, you've been unemployed for 6 months and you get a great job, but it's in another city or another state. You can't sell your house, but you really need the job. So one option people are looking into is commuting. Another reason for the rise is dual career couples. So again, if one person has a new job opportunity or has been unemployed, their spouse may have a really good job they like and aren't willing to relocate. Or for some couples where one spouse might be a teacher or a therapist or some sort of occupation that requires a license in each state, the rigor to get relicensed in the new state may not be worth it, at least in the initial point. So they'll start super commuting until they decide what they want to do. And then the third main one is, again, related to the economy with companies restructuring and reorganizing. In order to keep your job, you may have to take a position in a different office, and depending on what that requires, it may be a temporary situation and the family is not willing to relocate everybody in order to do that.
Well, I guess companies are probably a little bit less reluctant in this economy to actually go through the whole thing that they used to do quite a lot of buy your house and sell it or pay for the whole moving expenses and stuff. So if things are that bad and they're shutting down, you may be on your own then.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, so you deal with this in your private practice. You're a licensed marriage and family therapist. Talk about some of the people that you see and the issues that they face.
Well, it really depends on the couple, obviously, but one of the main, at least negative aspects that comes up a lot is the issue of resentment. As you can imagine, if one spouse is left behind and all of a sudden they're in charge of raising the kids and handling the house and everything, sometimes for weeks at a time, if it's somebody who, for example, goes off and works at an oil field or is in the military, if communication, if those lines aren't kept open and revisited and such, the resentment can build. So it's a lot of times working with couples to figure out what their triggers are, how they can find more self-care. And a big suggestion that's really helpful for a lot of couples is figuring out what responsibilities they can farm out, for lack of a better word. Can they hire a house cleaning company, you know, once a month? Can they find a neighborhood babysitter to help out with the kids every once in a while? Things like that.
And do you find that they deal with that fairly well, or do they need guidance? Do people kind of make up their own? I mean, sure that there's people who fit into all these categories, but what are the common problems that you're seeing there with that?
Well, another problem relates to a term that's been called the Disney dad, where couples come in frustrated because when the commuter returns home, which is referred to as the reentry period, that mm-hmm. is often a flashpoint as well. They often want to have their time home, if it's only a weekend or a few days, to be about fun. And sometimes that means that the bedtimes get changed, the rules that have been in place while they're gone all of a sudden are out the door. And so that can cause a lot of conflict, as you can imagine, between two people. So again, it's about talking about parenting, you know, how can you increase the family, in quotation marks, that's around when the partner's away, and how can you make that transition back and forth a little bit smoother?
Now, I did a book on military fathers a couple of years back, and one of the things I found that I thought was really interesting was that when guys were able to take a leave from a deployment and come home in the middle of it, the wives were not always happy about that, because in a way it was too much of hello, goodbye, and it would have, they felt, I mean, it's felt guilty saying it, but some of them would have just said, well, it would be better for him just to stay for the whole thing and then come back at the end and stay.
Yes, exactly, and that speaks to that reentry period and how tricky it can be to navigate. And there's a whole chapter in the book about that. I called it, you know, hello, goodbye, repeat. And so how do you manage that revolving door? And I interviewed some military families as well, just because I thought if anybody's going to know how to navigate this, it's going to be those couples.
Were they any better at it?
I think some of them were, actually. You know, sometimes it took a little practice, but, you know, some of the couples, a lot of times, you know, the acknowledgement is the place to start of, yes, this is really hard, and this is how I pull away, or this is how I need to come back into the family. And, you know, honoring the feelings of, wow, life has moved on while I was gone, and how can I bring myself back into this family unit that was okay while I was away?
You talked about resentments that can build up of the Disneyland dad, or I guess could be just as well the Disneyland mom kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
There are some other kind of things. I mean, could you feel, or could there be resentment because we're focusing so much of our resources and attention on your job and not on mine? Does that
is also an issue that comes up. Sometimes when these couples, the spouse at home ends up either quitting their job or working part-time in order to, you know, balance it out again. And, yeah, sometimes there is that resentment of, like, my career's on hold and I can't do the sorts of things I want to do because of that, for sure. That's definitely something that can come up as well. Or we're following you around, or we're choosing to do this so that you can do your job better. But on the flip side of that, one thing I hear from a lot of couples is that because the spouse is away and they can work 10 or 12-hour days, or they don't have to do that commute every day back and forth, you know, 2 or 3 hours in the car, they're actually able to perform really well at their job, and then for the sake of the family. So it's kind of a double-edged sword that you really need to keep an eye on.
Do you find that some marriages thrive with this kind of thing, or some relationships thrive in this environment where others might not?
They do, actually. And that's one thing that really, you know, came out of at least the people I interviewed, is that for a lot of them, it actually works really well. You know, they have bumps, obviously, but they've gotten really good at, you know, keeping an eye on them. But some people really like, and this was something that was a bit of a surprise, is actually a lot of the women I spoke with actually enjoyed having their own bedroom to themselves, which is kind of a tricky topic. But when I started looking into more research out there, there, you know, home builders are finding more people requesting 2 master bedrooms in new builds. Sometimes it's sleep apnea. Like, there's all kinds of reasons where having their bedroom on their own is really something they enjoy. So I thought that was an interesting thing that kind of unexpectedly came out of that. But another thing, too, is that it can allow both partners to have a life independent and not have to feel guilty about, you know, taking time away from the relationship when it's inherently the way it is.
Did you find that parents have an easier or harder time than non-parents?
I think the parents have a harder time. I think it's, you know, just parenting is hard in general, so it's just one more area of stress. You know, and I think the key in making that less difficult is getting really good at asking for help, or at least having people in place to ask if something happens, versus trying to figure it out all on your own by yourself. I think that's a big pitfall.
Yeah, well, I guess with the parents, though, you in addition to having to manage the husband-wife relationship, you have to manage what's going on with the kids and how the kids are going to react, because, of course, that Disneyland syndrome gets in there, or discipline, or pretty much anything else.
Yeah,
it's going to be an additional complication.
Right. And so one thing I suggest is if there is some sort of other adult figure in their life, whether it's a grandparent or aunt or just somebody that's close to the family, is that all three of those people, or four, however many people end up getting involved, really need to be on the same page about things like rules and discipline and activities and things like that, because they're going to shift and change as the children grow. And another, too, is to, you know, how are you going to tell the children about this, that suddenly their parent is gone? And for some families, they've been doing this for a long time, and that's just kind of the way it is. So you just definitely have to keep an eye on that.
Megan Bierce is the author of Super Commuter Couples, Staying Together When a Job Keeps You Apart. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Megan. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Megan Bierce, who's the author of Super Commuter Couples, Staying Together When a Job Keeps You Apart. I want you to spend some time talking to us about the kinds of things that couples can do to help them through these super commuting things. But before that, I just want you to touch on infidelity, which is something I'm sure that a lot of people worry about, whether it's an actual problem or whether it's just a perceived one. You know, you said something about oil rigs. So I imagine if a guy's going off to work with a bunch of other guys in the middle of the ocean on an oil rig, there's probably less suspicion than if somebody's going off to work in an office with a lot of people of the opposite sex. How often does that come up?
You know, when I interviewed the different people, there was only 2 incidents of infidelity that came out of the people I talked with, and one of them was pretty adamant that that was going to happen whether or not there was a commute. The other one thought maybe there was, you know, a little bit of lack of work on the relationship from both sides. So I think it really just speaks, like with any relationship, and it could be even with couples where there is no commute but people are working all the time, is just making sure you're taking care of yourself and you're taking care of the relationship. You know, little things like just a text saying, hey, I miss you, or I'm a big fan of, you know, when's the last time you told your spouse thank you? You know, whether that's for helping unload the dishwasher or for working so hard or things like that. So, you know, infidelity, there's a million reasons it happens. So I don't feel that a super commute equals infidelity.
You know, a lot of things with the military, getting back to that for just a second, mm-hmm. there's a lot of emphasis that's placed on the what's going on with the people at home, how they're right. being affected by this. And we're kind of talking about that also in those kinds of terms, that the person at home has to deal with the coming and going and the constant leaving and the discipline issues and stuff like that. But we don't talk quite as much, and I think we should, about how these things are affecting the person who's actually doing the commuting.
Right.
That they're missing out on a lot of stuff, and they're probably not happy about that. And you know, they're missing child developmental milestones, or they're missing events that are happening because they can't be there. How do you do you think, speaking of saying thank you, that the people at home are appreciative of the sacrifices that are being made by the person who's doing all the traveling?
I think sometimes that can get lost in the shuffle. So it's definitely something important to keep in the forefront. And I think today's technology can really help with that. You know, there's Skype, if people want to Skype, there's photo postcards, and there's definitely ways to stay connected. But again, it needs to go both ways. One thing that my husband is a super commuter, that we did that was really helpful, a couple of things were a little journal that was laying out in our kitchen. And so if there's some little or big milestone that happened that week, you know, we jot them down in the book, so, or they draw little pictures in there or things like that, so that when he comes home on Friday night, he can flip the book open and see the different things. There's things like Facebook and emailing pictures. But it definitely takes work. And unfortunately, it's one more thing that the person at home needs to be responsible for. But I think that's one way to help the person who's away feel more connected.
You have in the book, one of the chapters is called Three Common Themes in Successful Supercommuter Relationships. So mm-hmm. let's talk about what some of those things are. What characteristics does a couple have that makes them likely to be able to weather this whole thing a little bit better than other people?
One thing, and I think I touched on it a little bit earlier, is expanding their definition of family. It's building up their support network at home. And again, that kind of reflects a military family sort of situation where people are on base and have gone through this together. And so for super commuters, those couples, it can be people in their place of worship, it can be, you know, relatives, it can be friends of classmates, things like that. One is, again, really focusing on staying connected, finding humor in the situation, finding the silver lining. That was some of the strongest couples I spoke with in terms of, you know, how healthy their relationship was. They really did focus on what the positive aspects were of the commute. And that can be a simple exercise to do with couples in a therapy session, is list all the things that this commute does provide your family, and not just monetarily. And so that those days when it's really hard, you have something concrete that you can focus back on about, you know, why we're doing this and what it does for us. A lot of the families who are doing it well as well were able to kind of think outside the box of, just because this might be hard in the moment, we don't know where this is going to lead, how we're going to grow as people, what opportunities may present themselves. And again, the re-entry period, the couples that did the best were the ones that figured out how each of them best navigates that. And that kind of ties into knowing how you communicate, how you prefer to communicate. An example I talk about is, you know, when somebody comes in the door for returning home from the commute, do they want to be hugged by their family and greeted with kisses, or are they the type that really just wants 5 minutes to themselves to kind of decompress from traveling? So little things like that really do add up. They sound simplistic at first glance, but they really do make the difference in the long run.
Yeah, no, often it's the little things that you never really would think are that big mm-hmm. that can actually make a huge difference, yeah. So when you were dealing with this on your own, was mm-hmm. it something that came up in after you had already been married and you both had jobs doing something and it was a situation you were used to, or was your husband working in a different place that always?
No, what happened for us is, I'll give you the short version, is we had relocated to Minneapolis for his job, and shortly into that job, he got approached for a position in New York, and it was basically his dream job. But we had just purchased a house. My whole family was here in Minneapolis, and we weren't 100% sure, you know, would this job stick around? It was a new position, and we just weren't really willing to risk relocating our entire family to one of the most expensive areas of the country to live. So there was a lot of reasons why it just didn't make sense for us to do that. And so we entertained the thought of a super commute. And, you know, it was going to be a year, try it out for at least a year and see how it goes. And he had met some people who were doing it, so he talked to them, and that was a really important piece of trying to find mentors, trying to find people to talk to that do this to give you some tips. And so we kind of just, you know, put it out there, and we started it, and it's been 3 years. And
wow.
There's definitely been some ups and downs, but it's definitely been a really great experience in a lot of respects as well.
Well, what have the ups been?
The ups have been is he has had an amazing experience career-wise. He works in advertising, and there's really no MBA for that per se. So the experience he's getting is about the equivalent of that. He's working with amazing people at an amazing company on projects he probably would not have had the opportunity to locally. So that's been really great, and it's been nice to have our kids see me, you know, taking all this on and doing it well and seeing us support each other in our careers. And another piece of that was if I moved, I would have to get relicensed again as a therapist. I wasn't willing to do that. And he, you know, didn't say, oh, you have to come. So I think the respect that we show each other is something I'm really proud of that we're modeling for our kids.
Well, what's been the downside?
The downside is it's hard for the kids to have their dad away at times. You know, there's days that are great and there's days that are hard. So we just really try to make a point of when he's home, it's about quality family time. And so, unfortunately, that means that we don't have our kids in as many activities as maybe some families do. But in the short run, I feel like it's more important for us to have that time together instead of being stressed out running around to different soccer games and volleyball games and things like that. You know, the downside is just not having him around as much.
Sure. Yeah.
But again, it's the things you would think of that are hard.
And how are the kids handling this? What's their thinking?
They were two and four, I think, when we started. I can't even remember now. It's been such a blur. Yeah, because he just turned five. Our youngest, he was kind of too young to really understand what was going on when it started. Our daughter had a really hard time with it, but we've, you know, put into place things that have made it easier for her. And so, I mean, we call them when they're sad. Like I've mentioned, the book. We've taken family vacations to New York, and that's been really helpful because we've been able to stay in his apartment. We go meet his coworkers. We've, you know, go to the places he eats, so we can reference those things, and they have a connection to him when he says, oh, I ate at this burger place we went to before, and they have a personal experience with that. So that's been helpful as well.
What do you think are the most successful ways of staying in touch with the family while you're gone? That seems to be a really big thing, but again, with the military, that being connected with people while you're gone makes it easier for that reentry period.
Exactly. For us, phone has been helpful. A lot of people like Skype. Some complaints about Skype are that you really need to be conscious. I think the kids kind of need to set the schedule with that, because what happens, kind of similar to what you mentioned with the reentry, is that, you know, the person away calls up in the middle of dinner or the middle of a play date, and it's too hard for the kids to switch gears like that versus having something set up that works for the kids' schedule, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Especially
as they get older.
Like I mentioned, the photo postcards, those are fun, and those can work both ways. What happens is you take a picture with your smartphone, and it turns it into a traditional postcard that gets mailed to the house. So he'll take pictures of a dog he saw walking to work or something neat he saw out and about and sends it to the kids. So that's like a fun surprise in the mail, you know, a card from dad. The military, to do it the other way, I got some ideas for things like a Hug a Hero doll, which you take a photo and they silk screen it onto basically like a stuffed animal, but it's the face of the person and the body,
right,
and you can
sure.
put clothes on it, and they can stick a little note in the pocket. So it's like a pillow that they can hug at night. So there's different things like that depending on, you know, the age and needs of the child.
Megan Bierce is the author of Super Commuter Couple, Staying Together When a Job Keeps You Apart. Megan, thanks very much for joining us here. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and Sam Fuse is here. She's my co-writing partner on the Parents at Play column, which you can find at parentsatplay.com. Sam, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Before we went on the air, we were talking about dolls, and both of us have had a really great opportunity to review a lot of dolls over the past couple weeks, and you were looking at one from Gund, right? Peekaboo Dolly. You really like Gund a lot, don't you?
They're one of my favorite stuffed toy brands. And the Peekaboo Dolly is one of their big sellers. She's really cute. She's one of the Dolly brands, the little pink outfit, the little blonde hair. that general line. And this one, you push her little hand, and she picks up her blankie over her eyes and says, "Oh, where did you go? Peek-a-boo, I found you." And a few other phrases, and she'll do that for about 40 seconds. She's really soft. She's really cute. She's plush to touch. Kids will just really enjoy playing with her.
And she's got kind of a scent, doesn't she?
No, not this one.
Not that one. Okay.
The one that you're thinking of that's scented is the Cozy Cutie.
Ah, okay. And I knew that there was something, because I remember touching some of these things and thinking, boy, they really have done an amazing job of capturing kind of skin texture. And there was that scent. Well, why don't we talk about that one, too, the Cozy Cutie, since I've already gone out and made an idiot of myself.
The Cozy Cutie, I think, you know, the Cozy Cutie does have a little scent to it. But the more unique thing, I think, about Cozy Cutie is that you can make it go potty. And as we discussed about the, you know, fun trends from Toy Fair this year is everything pees and everything poops. Cozy Cutie pees. And you can give it liquid, and it will go on its own special potty. So as much as you give it a drink, it'll make pee-pee. And I think that's really fun for a couple of reasons. One is if you're potty training your child, you can kind of, oh, look, quick, who can go faster, you or your baby? And, oh, look, your baby can go potty, so why don't you go potty? And then the other fun thing is, as we all know, kids like repetition. So your child will sit in the kitchen and refill and make pee-pee, and refill and make pee-pee your little baby all day long. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've noticed that you've been calling these dolls she, and that kind of reminded me of some of the discussions that we had with some of the people at Toy Fair about where are the boys' dolls or the dolls for boys.
Yeah, you know, I'm really into gender-neutral dolls. And,
I know.
You know, dolls that are also for boys. These dolls were all pink, though. So these dolls, I think, are definitely she, because they are pink and they are covered in pink bows, and they are, these dolls in this week's column are definitely female dolls. There's just no getting around that.
I was kind of wondering, though, if anybody makes a doll, I mean, you know, would you have a doll who pees standing up as opposed to one that you put on
the
potty?
I have never seen one. That doesn't mean they don't exist, but I actually have looked for one, and I've never found one. Peekaboo Dolly, though, does have Peekaboo Bear as a counterpart, and that one is blue, cream-colored and cream-colored blanket. So that's at least something that a boy could use, or, you know, a child who doesn't necessarily love pink. And I know Adora, they make Playtime Baby Love, and that one is the one who is very scented with the baby powder scent. They also have some boy dolls available, but boy dolls can be very difficult to find. Baby Go-Go, who is not in this week's column, is a very gender-neutral doll. She mm-hmm. or he, whatever you prefer to call it, comes in a the typical doll comes in an orange and white onesie, and the doll does not have any decorative pieces on it or bows or anything like that. And most of its accessories, like its little carrier and things like that, are also orange and white.
Right.
You can buy extra outfits and make it a boy or a girl, but it comes in orange and white, and it's Baby Go-Go, not, you know, Baby Susie or Baby Bobby.
You know, we're going to be doing a lot more columns on dolls because it's such a big topic. But I want to you mentioned the Playtime Baby from Adora. I was wondering about this. They're handmade. How many people do they have working at a factory? I mean, they're selling a lot of these dolls. How can anybody make anything by hand anymore?
Well, they have a wide spectrum of dolls. Some of their dolls are less expensive, and all of their dolls are not painted by hand. They're not done by hand. They're special dolls. They're kind of higher quality dolls are the ones that are made by hand. And they also have some plush dolls, and those are not made by hand either.
Well, that's the end of this week's column. You can get a lot more reviews of a lot more toys, not only dolls, but lots and lots of other things at parentsatplay.com. Sam, say goodbye.
Bye.
I'm Armin Brott.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
It kind of freaks me out that some people actually go through their trash to pull out recyclables. That's not for me.
Maria Inez Phillips talks about not recycling.
I've got too many newspapers and magazines and catalogs in there with plastic containers and bottles and cans.
In your recycling bin?
No, in my trash.
Your trash can is full of recyclables?
No, it's full of trash.
You say trash, Maria. I say rubbish.
Whatever it is, I'm not going through it.
I don't even know what they do with recyclables.
They make more of the things you use, Maria. More newspapers, more bottles and cans.
Out of a bunch of trash? I just don't get it.
Some things are very obvious, Maria. Recycling creates jobs and protects the environment. Is that important to you?
It is, which is why I put my trash where it belongs.
Learn the difference between trash and recycling and more on our website, yougottabekidding.org.
I put out way too much trash to think about recycling.
See why recycling is not rubbish. Visit yougottabekidding.org today.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey there, and welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting for Military Family show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott. In February 2011, 61-year-old Christine Casey delivered the greatest gift of all to her daughter, Sarah Cannell, Sarah's son, Finian. At that moment, Christine, who's the gestational carrier of Sarah and her husband Bill's child, became the oldest woman ever to give birth in Chicago. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Sarah Cannell about the tragedy and the heartbreak of losing pregnancies and the process of opening her heart and her mind to the rather unusual idea of her 61-year-old mother carrying her child for her. And we'll talk about the profound bond that blossomed between this mother and daughter as a result of their incredibly unique experience together. Sarah's book is called Bringing in Finn, An Extraordinary Surrogacy Story, and it actually is an extraordinary story. It goes beyond the simple tale of one woman's hard-fought and painful journey to motherhood and ends up being a modern-day miracle story, a journey of a couple who wanted really nothing more than to have a baby and of a mother who would do anything, anything for her daughter. I'm Armin Brott. Stay with us for a discussion of surrogacy, motherhood, technology, and most of all, the incredible things that can be accomplished with unconditional love. It all starts when positive parenting continues right after this.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Sarah Cannell, who's the author of Bringing in Finn, An Extraordinary Surrogacy Story. Sarah, welcome to Positive Parenting.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, give us an overview of the story. In the introduction, I mentioned something about how your mother was the one who actually gave birth to your son. But just give us the broad strokes, and we'll talk about in greater detail as we go on.
Sure. My husband and I, like a lot of couples, got married and very much wanted to have children. That was always part of our hope and dream for life together. And he's a wonderful guy. And we worked for a couple years after we got married and were living abroad and came back to the United States and said we want to start our family. And we're very hopeful. We were both young, healthy, et cetera, and got into things and just weren't getting pregnant. And so like many couples that, you know, we hear about now, we had the story of going to different doctors and finally a fertility specialist and were basically, you know, guided towards possibly using IVF or some other assisted fertility process because we just weren't getting pregnant on our own. And so we went down that route and very, very joyfully got pregnant with twins. So we were thrilled and ecstatic after several years of trying to be pregnant, and the pregnancy was wonderful, and the twins were developing beautifully. We found out they were two boys. And then pretty late in the pregnancy, around 5.5 months, I went into premature labor, and the boys were delivered stillborn. So it was a really tough experience, a tough time,
just because of losing the children, but also the years that had led up trying to even become pregnant. So we were pretty pretty devastated, and we knew, though, we still wanted to have a family. So we kept trying. I had a miscarriage a year later and did some more fertility treatments, and at that point we decided we needed a break. And we decided to take about 8 or 9 months and not talk about fertility and not try to get pregnant and just really, you know, to be honest, prayed about how we might be able to have a family and just try to open our hearts to whatever path that might look like, whether that might be adoption or continuing to try. And during this time, my mother, who had been an incredible source of support through our entire journey, suddenly heard about a woman who'd given birth, a postmenopausal woman who'd given birth to a baby, and this idea came in her mind to offer to be a surrogate for us. And it was nothing we'd ever imagined or had heard of and definitely did not think was probably possible. She made this incredible offer, and I was just completely moved and touched, and just something in me kind of cracked open, like maybe this is the way that we're going to have a family. So even though it sounded completely crazy, we did end up talking to our team of fertility doctors, and they did a huge battery of tests on my mother and decided that they would support us in trying this out and trying to have our child this way. And very happily, this process worked, and my mother carried our son, Finn, who is now this amazing, rambunctious, wonderful little toddler, and that is how he came into the world.
Well, there's so many things to go on there. I'm kind of amazed that you guys didn't just give up. I mean, a lot of times, particularly, I mean, stillborn twins after, I mean, I saw some of the pictures in the book, you look incredibly happy. That's just got to be hard to come back from all by itself.
Yeah, it's really a rough thing, and I do so much work now as a counselor and a coach around, you know, people who are going through fertility and women who've had this issue especially, and it's just losing a child, even if some people say, oh, the child wasn't born yet, and you know, but it's a big deal. It's a hard loss for a lot of people. It definitely was for me and for my husband and I together. So I think the only thing I can say is that our desire to have a family and have children was stronger than the pain and the trauma of the loss, I guess I could say. And so we took an attitude for you know, different people would have a different response, but our attitude was we are going to do whatever it takes to be able, you know, to have children. That might have included, of course, there's many options. Surrogacy and continue to try on your own is, of course, only a couple. But we just really felt that deep down in our core somewhere, and we kept going.
Well, without getting too much into your personal finances, it's an expensive process, and a lot of people are forced to give it up for that reason.
Yes.
It didn't sound like that was as much of an issue for you guys.
Well, what we had, we were incredibly blessed to have an insurance plan. Illinois, where I live, in Chicago, one of the main insurance plans, which we ended up being on and didn't know this at the time, covered a couple of rounds. So our first few rounds of in vitro were covered, and then we had to keep taking breaks in between and sort of raise the money. My husband and I both work for ourselves and, again, have been blessed to have a nice income, and so we were able to – we didn't want to go into debt. We knew that was really important to us, that to be able to, you know – do this as we went along, but we would make some more money, and then we'd do another cycle. And it is a huge financial factor. It's $20,000+ per cycle, so it's a really big deal, and not available for everyone for that reason.
Well, I'm just going to keep going on the financial stuff. How did it work with your mother? Was, I mean, because she's probably not on your insurance policy,
right?
And
it was so
she's
wild.
Probably,
you know,
not.
Said, what are they going to cover up? 60-year-old for prenatal care, you know.
Yeah.
So we called, as we were considering this idea, we decided to check everything out ahead of time so there weren't any surprises to anybody financially. And interestingly, my father had worked for the government for his career. I grew up in the D.C. area, and my parents have incredible insurance. And turns out that her insurance plan covered some of the prenatal, like the checkups and that sort of thing. We paid for all the fertility part of things, the getting pregnant part, and then our insurance kicked in as soon as Finn was born. And so it was really interesting. So it's kind of a combination, but different plans obviously would all, I'm sure, have a unique, you know, way that they handled that. But that's what it looked like for ours.
Did anybody call about that?
Well, we called ahead of time because what we didn't want to have happen is someone calling and saying, you know, you shouldn't have done that, you know, because this was a planned pregnancy. It wasn't like my mother, you know, spontaneously became pregnant.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make sure that we had called, because if we had to cover that out of pocket, we wanted to know ahead of time and have time to say more, do something. So we did call ahead of time and speak with at both of our insurance companies to verify what the coverage would be. So it was pretty incredible that we got as much coverage as we did.
Yeah, I'm just amazed by that, actually, because it seems like that this is an era where insurance companies are looking for any excuse to not cover things. And I mean, I would have expected that somebody, some file clerk someplace would say, wait a minute, she's 60 years old.
Right.
That can't possibly be. There's got to be a typo here someplace.
Right.
But they went along with it.
Yeah, we checked it first to just say, look, this is what we're trying to do, and what would it look like if we are able to get pregnant this way? And they were really clear about here's what we cover, here's what we wouldn't. So we did have an accurate idea going in.
And how did your mother handle things? I mean, at the risk of sounding like a guy, 60-year-old women are not built for having babies.
Right. I mean, it had been 30 years since she'd been pregnant. I have two sisters, so she'd had three very easy, healthy, you know, pretty easy pregnancies. And of course, you know, that's a whole different thing. And there is not a lot of precedent for someone being pregnant at this age. She was phenomenal. She did feel very tired, which was what they said would be the for sure to count on symptom. The things they were concerned about with someone at an advanced age, like preeclampsia, which is sort of high blood pressure and other type of complications, she ended up not having. She had an easier pregnancy than a lot of my 30-year-old friends. It was really incredible. And we were together for the pregnancy. I really wanted to get to be with Finn the whole time, and we didn't know that was his name, of course, then, but be with the baby. And so I was in D.C. for the beginning parts of the pregnancy, and my mom actually came and lived with us for kind of from the 3-month point onward, 3 or 4 months onward.
Now, legally, how did that work? So biologically,
right,
it's yours and your husband Bill's.
Yes.
Was there some legal issue? Maybe you had to adopt the child, something? How did that work?
Fascinating. So each state has different laws around these things. Illinois, where we were for the pregnancy and where Finn was born, recognizes the biological parents, period, as the parents of the child. So there was no adoption or anything in this case. Whoever is the biological parents are the parents of that child. In other states, had we, for instance, had the baby in the D.C. area in Virginia, my parents are in Alexandria, then it's not actually an adoption, but there is a legal document that has to happen because that state honors whoever's carrying the child. To a certain extent. So it wasn't a full adoption, but there is an actual legal document that would have had to be drawn up and executed if we were to give birth there or in several other states. So Illinois just happens to be one that the biology is recognized from the beginning.
Speaking with Sarah Cannell, who's the author of Bringing in Finn, an extraordinary surrogacy story. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Sarah about this extraordinary story. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sarah Cannell, who's the author of Bringing in Finn, an extraordinary surrogacy story. And we've just been talking about the whole process and some of the legal things, I guess, and financial things that sort of fascinate me about this. How did the conversation go? I'm curious, that very first conversation when your mother says, hey, I got an idea.
Yes, it was definitely an epic moment, I think, in our family. My mother was so nervous about making the suggestion that she actually wrote a letter. She wrote it in a letter and said she was coming to visit. She and my father were coming to visit, and she said, I want you to read something. And I had, of course, no expectation or idea of what was contained there. I thought it was something maybe that she was thinking about for her own life, and read the letter. And I, as I'd shared before, it really was a profound moment for me. It was like
something kind of opened up where it felt like a door had been really locked is the best way I can explain it. I just had a sense of new hope because we'd had such a rough few years. And even though the idea was so preposterous sounding and like science fiction or something. So the conversation was first, I guess, with my husband. I told him what my mom had suggested. And then it was a very odd dinner with my mother, my father, my husband, and I sitting around saying, okay, now this idea is on the table, and what? I think both my husband and father have since said they just didn't think there was any way this could actually happen. So they were like, wow, this is amazing, but I can't imagine this could actually be possible. And for whatever reason, my mother and I kind of thought maybe it would be, and it was so it was a moment of, I think my husband and I were both so struck, we kept off and on sort of crying, that at the generosity of her offer, regardless of if anything could happen, if it was possible, just the tremendous sacrifice she was willing, you know, the generosity of her spirit to be able to offer something like that was, it just really, it really took us a while to even take that in.
So I'm imagining before that letter came to you or before she and your dad came to you, there must have been some big conversations on her end. Did
right.
your dad try to talk her out of it or, how did those conversations go?
He's such an amazing, they have an incredible marriage. They've been married 41 years this summer. And one thing that my mom has always been a very conventional person. I mean, just absolutely a kind of just a very appropriate conventional. She said until this, she had never done anything, you know, something unexpected, I think she said, in her life. And my father, you know, I guess when she told him the idea, I guess it was a month or so before she shared it with us, he was a little bit scared. He was surprised, of course. He'd never heard of this kind of idea either. And then what he told me later in front of her was that she had supported him in everything he'd ever wanted to do throughout their relationship and their marriage. And he could feel this was something really deep in her heart and her soul that she wanted to do and that he was going to support her. And I just have to think it's sometimes maybe scarier to talk to other people to be the partner of someone doing something, you know, because you have no control and you're not. So I think there was a huge gift of generosity on his part as well. Certainly the walking through the fears he might have felt for my mother's health and safety, but also, you know, she came and lived with us for a number of months and he certainly visited quite a bit of that, but, you know, to be without her for that time.
So she was with you guys, which probably, I'm guessing, maybe made it a little bit easier for her to deal with, that she wouldn't have to have her bridge partners and stuff, you know, at home making kinds of comments. So I just can't imagine that nobody wouldn't have said, "Are you out of your mind?"
Right. I mean, what people typically when she and my father finally told a couple of friends, they didn't tell many people, and we didn't either, just less because of it being about the surrogacy. But I was still so, you know, it was almost like until this baby is ready to be born, I almost didn't want to talk about it, you know, because of the experience we'd had before. So we didn't tell a lot of people, but the couple of friends they had first thought they were just joking. They thought, oh, this is what kind of silly, you know, what are you talking about? And then when they realized that my parents were serious, people were just a little bit shocked and also a bit, what my parents expected was some judgment, you know, or a sense of, you know, maybe even revulsion or being repelled. But actually most people were just incredibly moved and incredibly supported. And I don't think as a family we expected quite that much right up front as people realized it was a real thing. There was just a tremendous amount of respect and encouragement, which is beautiful and unexpected.
Now, for most couples, birth is kind of a private thing. There'd be the father, the mother, and some medical people. Who all was there at the...
Right.
I mean, was your dad there to help her through, or who's helping?
Right.
Who's kind of her
right.
labor coach?
Well, the doctors really were hoping for a natural delivery. My mom had had her through pregnancies that way. And so my father flew out when it was time for another to go into labor. So the four of us, my father, mother, Bill, and I, are in the labor part of things. And then my mother's cervix didn't dilate, you know, to the point of being able to do a natural birth. So they decided after 36 hours of not hard labor but early labor, which my mom kept saying, "Don't I get a special treatment for being, you know, the grandmother?" But
Anyway, when they realized they needed, they decided to do a C-section. So at that point, only one person besides the person giving birth is allowed in the room, aside from the medical personnel. So I was the one that got to be there. And my father and Bill and our other family waited in the waiting room, and my mother and I were there together. And it was truly, I think most parents may say that witnessing the birth of their child or children is the most extraordinary moment of their life, and I certainly feel that way. It really was for me, of course, intensified by the fact that this was so far from anything I would have imagined in terms of the birth of my first child, that it would be, you know, with my mom in the room, and the situation that we had, and it was all I remember is just waiting to hear the is my mother okay? And if hearing the cry of the baby, I think after having our experience with the twins, it was like that was the sound I'd been waiting for, really for the 9 months, but I realized later for about 7 years since we'd started to, you know, our journey of trying to become parents.
I've written an awful lot about pregnancy and childbirth and looking at it usually from the dad's perspective, but it seems to me in conversations I've had with women that motherhood, In many ways, it's the process of getting there that's very important as well. The pregnancy itself and how that felt and the feelings of the kicks and all those, that sort of stuff. You didn't have any of that. And how do you think that diminishes in your view motherhood,
you know,
in some way?
It's really, yeah, it's so interesting because having been pregnant with the twins, I'm grateful to have had some sense of being able to compare, like, what was it like to, you know, feel the babies inside me versus the surrogacy pregnancy. And I will say that I felt so connected to Finn from the beginning because I had the gift of being with my mom and with him for most days of the pregnancy and at all the doctor's appointments and everything. Of course, it's not the same as physically feeling your body grow and seeing it in your body. But I will say it was as close as I could have gotten without that experience. I felt incredibly connected. And what was a really amazing moment early on, because of course I worried, would this baby feel connected to me? I didn't know how that would work for this new life. And I would, as soon as we got pregnant, I would read every day we read Harry Potter and sang songs, and I would read every day to the baby with my mom, whether it was over the phone or in person then later on. And as soon as he got big enough to be kicking, the minute he heard my voice, my mom would say, "Oh my gosh, he's kicking! He's kicking!" So when he started to recognize my voice, that just really took it to another level of bonding. And that was the way. It's certainly not the same as carrying him, but it was our way that we started to really connect. And by the time he arrived, I felt really connected to him.
So are you going to have another one?
Yeah, not with my mom. It's definitely a one-time thing. We all agreed it was amazing, and we wouldn't do a surrogacy again with her, just to honor her health. She was 61 when he was born, so she definitely felt like that was her opportunity, her window and chance to do it. Interestingly, if I was able to get pregnant again, there's a new procedure that had come out, and a doctor here in Illinois, amazingly enough, does for people who've had what I had when I went into premature labor. There's a procedure to really reinforce the cervix that is almost 100% success rate. It's very, very high, and it wasn't the procedures they were doing when we were getting pregnant and to the surrogacy did not have that kind of success rate. So if Bill and I were able to get pregnant again, we would love and welcome and be so thrilled to have another child, and I would have that procedure and try to carry. And because we didn't have the easiest time getting pregnant, that may not happen either, and we feel so blessed to have Finn, and we're having such an awesome time being parents. It's definitely everything we hoped for and more, and so we feel so blessed to have what we have, and again, if we are able to have more, that would be great, and we feel really, really, really happy with our family as it is now.
Sarah Cannell is the author of Bringing in Finn, an Extraordinary Surrogacy Story. Sarah, great to have you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com.
While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.